360's The Week That Was, the most listened to hour in Territory Radio. The Territory leaders break down this week's big issues.
Good morning and welcome to the show. What a massive day we've got lined up for you, kicking off with The Week That Was, that is now proudly brought to you by De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers, and also broadcasting, of course, in Alice Springs. Now, joining us in the studio this morning, we have got the Health Minister, Natasha Files. Good morning.
You're going the wrong way around the room.
I went the opposite way.
You caught me off guard. Good morning.
And we have also got Kezia Purick, the member for Goyder. Good morning to you.
Oh, good morning, Katie. I'm just tidying up the desk.
A bit messy. And then we have
good
got
morning.
For her debut, Marie-Claire Boothby. Good morning to you, Marie-Claire, from the CLP, opposition obviously opposition spokesperson for various different portfolios. Welcome.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Lovely to have you all in the studio. Now, I do want to just start off this morning with this this review of the COVID vaccine. We know that there is an updated advice on the AstraZeneca vaccine. It's going to be discussed at National Cabinet today. Natasha, as I understand it, though, there was a meeting of health ministers late yesterday afternoon. Can you just sort of update us on that most recent advice?
Thanks, Katie. So yesterday afternoon and last night, State and Territory Health Ministers, along with the Commonwealth Minister Greg Hunt and our Chief Medical and Chief Health Officers, had a couple of meetings. And this followed meetings of ATAGI and AHPPC. Many of your listeners are familiar with AHPPC, the group nationally, but ATAGI is the Technical Advisory Group on Immunisations. The message, Katie, is that the vaccine is still safe for the broader population, but we have seen a very small number of young people getting these rare blood clots. And so based on that, the Australian authorities have said that it is preferred that Pfizer is the vaccine for people 50 and under. But Katie, I know that there's some people that would have already had their first dose of AstraZeneca. They are still okay to receive that second dose. What we've seen is these clots appear after the first dose, typically. And also the evidence for people over 50 is that they're at much greater risk of the impact of COVID than from a blood clot. It's been in younger people internationally, and there's been one case in Australia.
So just how real is this threat? Because I know that there'll be some people out there listening thinking to themselves, well, goodness me, I was already a little bit worried about getting the vaccine and this has turned me right off.
So, Katie, it's important for people to understand that vaccines and, in fact, all medicines, the longer that they are around, there is more reviews done, looked at how they are taken up in the community and any impact. So it's not unusual to revisit a medication or a vaccine and make changes. And so this has been done off that clinical evidence. As I just said, there's been one case in Australia of this very rare clotting, but it can be quite significant on the individual. There is a chance of death or severe disability. And so that's why this decision's been made.
How many doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine were we anticipating arriving in the Northern Territory?
So, Katie, I don't have that figure in front of me. What I can say is that over 12,000 Territorians have been vaccinated to date, and around 2,000...
With AstraZeneca or...?
Pfizer and some AstraZeneca. I don't have the breakdown. I'd be happy to get that for you off air. We have around 2,000 people that have had the second dose, and they would be all Pfizer because the second dose for Pfizer is 3 weeks. AstraZeneca's second dose is 9 to 12 weeks.
Yeah. Okay, so I suppose what I'm getting at here is how far behind is this going to delay the rollout of the vaccine?
This absolutely is going to impact the vaccine program in the Northern Territory and around Australia. We're going to have to recalibrate our program. Katie, as well as Pfizer, there is other vaccines that are being looked at and being trialled and being assessed by our health authorities. The Novavax is one, and the federal government has got some of that vaccine on order. So thankfully we don't have community transmission, and so we can take our time. This is a significant change in the advice, but it's really important for people to understand it is very, very rare. It's in a specific population. The bigger risk would be if we did see COVID coming to our community.
Is it with the AstraZeneca, with these blood clots, if somebody is going to have one of these blood clots, I know, like you've said, that it is rare, but is it something that happens immediately or is it something that can happen weeks after receiving that vaccine?
Katie, my understanding is it happens very soon after, and it hasn't happened. It's a chance reaction to the vaccine, and all cases, as I've been advised, happen after that first dose, and so it is safe to get that second dose if you've already had your first dose of AstraZeneca.
So I suppose anybody out there listening who's maybe already had it and is thinking to themselves, goodness me, am I at risk right now of a blood clot? If something was going to happen to them, let's say that they received that vaccine 2 weeks ago, if something was going to happen to them, realistically it would have by now?
So when the vaccine, when an individual gets a vaccine, it's an almost immediate reaction within the hours and days following as the body absorbs that vaccine and reacts to it, which is what we want to create those antibodies. But we heard last night from both Greg Hunt and Brendan Murphy, our federal minister and the Department Secretary of Health, both of them have had the first shot and will be getting the second shot. So it very much is around that first dose, and it is in a very, very small number of people. But as I outlined, more we have medicines and vaccines rolled out in the community, it's not unusual for that to change. And so a warning is now put on AstraZeneca that this can happen, similar to we see warnings on a range of medications.
I think what, apart from the very specific medical advice that Natasha's giving, or not medical advice, but the advice, I think it's beholden upon all of us, and particularly those in the medical world, is to get a consistent message out to people. And I would say if anyone's had like the first vaccine and they're in that age group, which is under 50, which could be the frontline workers, for example, and hospital staff, is talk to your doctor. You know, if you have any concerns or any queries or any worries, go back and talk to your medical doctor or wherever you got the vaccine from. But as Natasha said, look, any medicine you take comes with a risk, because whilst your medical doctor or the doctors will, you know, analyse you and, you know, look at what you've got and what you haven't got, there's always something in our little bodies that they can't pick up. And they have picked this up now. Like, I remember, we all had polio when we were kids.
Yep.
We had that little sugar thing. Well, I did anyway, back in the 60s. But when I went overseas to Kenya, I had to have polio again, because over the passing of time, the medical world had come to the decision, based on research and review, that the initial vaccine wasn't going to give you the protection. So that's just an example. Like, this has come out.
And, Katie, it's really important, the risk versus the benefit. So right now, there is a very low risk of coronavirus in our community, because presently in Australia, there's no community transmission. That can quickly change, which means the risk of coronavirus far outweighs the potential risk of this very rare blood clotting. And so the benefit of the vaccine, particularly in our vulnerable and older population, is so important.
The community, I think, are going to be relying really heavily on our health professionals in this space.
Sure are.
One of the questions I have for the government is, you know, what sort of measures are in place to make sure that all health professionals that are dealing with this vaccine are being notified immediately as these changes come forward? Because, of course, we are absolutely reliant on health advice here.
That's really important, Marie-Claire, and that was why these meetings were held last night, essentially, and that's why you saw the unusual situation with the Prime Minister and the Federal Minister stepping out at, I think it was about 7 p.m. our time, maybe a little bit before, because everyone has informed consent. So we couldn't go, you know, allow National Cabinet to discuss this today and people get their vaccine this morning. As soon as that information came out of ATAGI and AHPPC, the federal authorities acted upon that, and that was why it literally happened.
So it's sort of sending a bit of a mixed signal, though, because on one hand the government is saying like this risk is really very low, but then on the other hand they're holding a late night press conference and you're saying, you know, you couldn't have that risk of anybody being vaccinated this morning. So
no,
it,
Katie,
does just
it's
play
around
into
informed
the hands.
Consent, so people having, they have to have, as soon as we know the information, it has to be shared with the community,
and so then they've got the opportunity to choose whether they go with AstraZeneca or whether they go with the Pfizer vaccine.
Katie, it's making sure people have the full facts as soon as we made them, you know, available.
Can I just ask again, with the remote communities, were you planning on having a mixture of both of those vaccines head out there to those various remote communities, or what vaccine was going to go out to remote communities? And does this, again, is it going to cause a massive delay?
So, Katie, it is absolutely going to recalibrate our vaccine program. We had counted on AstraZeneca being utilised right across the Northern Territory, and so our officials right now, I've been speaking to them this morning, are heading into a range of meetings with state and territory and Commonwealth counterparts. And we will look at the availability of vaccine. The AstraZeneca can still safely be used for people receiving their second dose, for people over 50. So we still have a supply of AstraZeneca coming in. We clearly need Pfizer as well. We had a guaranteed supply of Pfizer. It's important for Territorians to know all of our frontline workers, pretty much, unless they've been on leave or, you know, for personal reasons, have been vaccinated. So we'll continue our program, but we will have to look at our figures and work out the variances because of this change in recommendation.
I just think it's just got to be good information coming from government, people like Natasha and the Chief Medical Officer, and consistent messaging, informed consent. It's exceptionally rare. It's very sad that the people have reacted, and sad that people have died, or that one person in Australia. But they know about it.
Yeah.
They've acted quickly. And I think, as Marie-Claire asked, I think the message is going to shoot round like lightning in the medical
and
world.
And, Katie, it's really important. It's hard for us in the Territory. You know, a few people have started to travel and they wear masks and they were caught up in Queensland. And it made them realise, you know, because apart from that initial lockdown, we've had relatively comfortable, you know, it hasn't had an impact on us day to day. But we are still at risk of an outbreak in Australia. The authorities made that very clear last night. And so we have to balance the risk of the outbreak versus the vaccine.
Yeah, and I, you know, I really think to myself, like I've seen on my own social media pages, you know, not my auntie, but a friend's auntie and other people sort of questioning whether they should actually go and get the vaccine. They're now eligible for it and questioning whether they should. You know, my biggest piece of advice for people is, like you said, Kezia, earlier, like everybody in this room has said, actually speak to the medical professional. Speak to your doctor about it. If you've got concerns and if you're worried that the side effects are going to be greater than actually getting the vaccine, have a talk to them about why you actually need it and the impact that it could have, but also the benefits of having it.
And also that individual's lifestyle and living arrangements. I mean, my mother's keen to get the vaccine and, you know, she's 93, but, you know, she's never going to travel on an aeroplane again, probably.
Yep.
You know, so if she wants it, but if she didn't want it, it'd be fine because, you know, that person's relatively isolated. You've got someone at Managrea that might stay out there. So it's about talking to your family and also for elderly people and perhaps people who are a little bit infirmed, talking to your family and also talking to your medical person and then getting the facts from them, then making your informed decision.
And I have to concur, like, Dr. Google is not the way to go in this case.
Don't ask Dr.
Just
Google.
Reach out to your GP. And Katie, there's I think because there's been talk around the vaccine and the flow of the vaccine coming through, people have sort of got the view, oh, it's hard to get, I won't bother. It's absolutely available. I was talking to someone on the weekend who, you know, phoned up, spoke to their GP. Yes, they provide it, so they're booked in within a week. Other GPs are calling some of their regular clients if they've got some spare and saying, you know, come in and get it. Mm. So the best thing, as Kezia was just saying, is contact your GP, go in, talk to them about your concerns, get your name on that list, and you know, it's a change in the advice, but it's with clinical evidence.
We're going to take a very short break.
360's The Week That Was, thanks to De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers.
You are listening to The Week That Was, and in the studio with us this morning, Marie-Claire Boothby, Kezia Pyrick and Natasha Files. Now, unfortunately, we started the week with some pretty shocking news and pretty shocking CCTV footage emerged of the moment that a gang of masked youths brazenly broke into a Darwin supermarket to allegedly steal alcohol. Now, this was at the Fanny Bay supermarket, and I think that, you know, all of us have been there. So many people in the community know Manuel, the owner, and his wife, Nitsa, who are lovely people who do a fantastic job. And it was just actually really sad, I reckon, to see what had gone on. And see the impact, you know, of... we're talking about a bloke who worked the whole weekend. You know, he was there on Easter Sunday until 8 or 9 p.m. at night. And then, you know, you've got people breaking in the early hours of your morning, when you should actually be able to sleep safely in bed without having to worry about that.
And Katie, what we've seen here is another example of how, unfortunately, our community is at a crisis point where it wasn't just one business in Fanny Bay that was broken into over Easter. There were several, and it has been continuing for a very long time. The one that was the offender in this case is allegedly a 16-year-old who was arrested and charged, and he already had a string of offences, including breaching suspended sentence and failing to comply with a youth court order. And, like, this is where it is just unacceptable that we continue to let these offenders get away with it, continue to go out and you know, put so much harm in the way of people who are trying to run their businesses, families who are trying to just have a nice life, you know, at home, sleeping with their family, and they have to worry about this time and time again.
Even last night, okay, so I'll take you to a story that's just occurred overnight. Maddie Hepworth, our news director, had spoken to the watch commander and had been advised that there was another break-in, this time at a home in Bakewell, a 14-year-old male on premises. Now, he entered the room, allegedly, of a 12-year-old girl and demanded money. I, you know, it's enough to make me have my children sleep in bed with me. You know, like, Katie, you're worried sick.
It's unacceptable. And Manuel lives in my electorate, and I've visited him. And, you know, he's a really hardworking. He loves that shop. He loves interacting with the community. And as I said to you earlier in the week, particularly over Easter, when, you know, some small businesses are, you know, working really hard, or they choose to take that break, it's absolutely unacceptable. So we've announced a range of measures. This is a grinding, hard work job. It's something that's, you know, going to have to be the focus of our government. And it's also been the focus, you know, of previous governments.
I want to just take you all to a little bit of audio from the Chief Minister, Michael Gunner, last Monday, because we've all been talking about these changes and when exactly they're going to be implemented and how it's all going to work. Take a listen to what he had to say last week. Is that your priority, realistically, given what we've all gone through and, you know, that vision that we saw on A Current Affair? Do you reckon this does need to go through urgently, and how soon then will police have that timeline?
That's about as simple as the timeline gets: introduction in May, possible urgency passage in May, and or there's a day in June, which is usually for estimates, which is the passage of the budget. It's hard to pass things on that day or August. So for me, my priority, the way I lean to it at the moment, is around May. We also want to get the legislation drafted right. Let's be really clear here. If you get the drafting of legislation in this space wrong, the people who win will be the criminal. So you don't want to do that. So you've got to get the drafting right.
So you've got to get it right. But your priority is that May is when this is going to happen.
Absolutely.
And will that mean that our police will realistically then be able to, you know, to be implementing these changes straight after that legislation goes through?
Yeah, the Gazette will date usually pretty soon after that. So you usually enact it very soon after you pass it in the May sittings.
Now, the reason I had asked that question of the Chief Minister is because I'd caught up with the Police Association President Paul McHugh last week, who had said that Northern Territory Police need a really clear timeline. So what this would mean is that we would obviously need to have these changes in legislation enacted on urgency, is my understanding.
So, Katie, we're working on the legislation as efficiently as we can. It's being worked on urgently by government agencies. Police, Attorney Generals, Chief Minister would be the three key agencies working through this. And as the Chief Minister said, you've got to get it right. You don't want to rush something and get it wrong. And then the urgency beyond that would be introduction. And then if it can be debated in that May sittings, which is what the Chief Minister's indicated he's aiming for, that would see it pass within that couple of weeks of May,
Katie,
and then be gazetted.
This was so urgent, which it is, because the community have been crying out for a very long time to have something changed. If it was so urgent of the Chief Minister, then why didn't he support the changes that we brought forward just 2 weeks ago to make changes to the bail, which could have had an immediate impact? The government just shut us down, didn't even let us debate it on urgency, which could have meant it could have been implemented the day after.
Yeah, look, I thought it was a bit rich that it wasn't even debated. I thought, could we at least have a look at it?
At least have a look to see what the opposition's got to say.
Yeah.
And we were ready with legislation. Legislation, when you are preparing that, takes months and months and months. So if the government thinks that they're going to have this ready in May, I really question that, because I know how long
they're dreaming.
Absolutely.
I think the expression is.
And it's a real worry, because we can't wait months and months and months.
We can't. And this is, you know, that's the frustration.
If I may jump in there.
Yeah.
The problem, I personally have no issues, and I think constituents have no issues with the legislation being passed quickly to give police the powers to do whatever they have to do. That's okay. But when you bring in legislation in on urgency, invariably you don't get it right. Now, government's known about this problem we've got in our community for months.
Years.
Not years.
Years and years.
So they've digged around, Chief Minister, you've digged around, and you don't even sound convincing on that interview that Katie just played, you know. So you should have done this last year. You should have done it in the February sittings when we did bugger all and just had puff pieces that, you know, people spoke to. So get it done. Don't just umbanaga about it. Be decisive. Lead.
Yeah,
lead or get out of the
really
way.
We fast during COVID. Why
lead
can't we
get
act
out of the way.
During this community crisis?
And, you know, I've made this point time and time again, and to the point where sometimes I feel like a broken record, but the community is continuing to cry out. You know, even this week, speaking to Manuel, it was upsetting. You think, you know, it shouldn't be happening.
Katie, that's a high-profile crime.
There are businesses across the territory.
I looked on Facey this morning, the lady, Amy Unn, that's got that Luxor place, she got broken into.
Oh, did she?
Yeah. There's some place at Palmerston that got broken into.
Yeah, another one at Parap yesterday, Fresh Point.
Pancakes. Now, that's the ones that you see, but there's a whole lot of shit going on down in the rural area mm-hmm. that people just don't talk about. There's properties being invaded, there's stuff being stolen, there's people casing joints, most of it suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
There's a particular silver car that people are looking out for because there's yep. a suspicious man in it looking at kids and all that sort of
oh,
shit.
Oh, yep, we did speak about that earlier in the week.
Yeah, it's not just these high-profile ones. It's endemic across the community.
Mm.
And this is just our town.
Well, and
there's Catherine Tennant and Alice suffering as
yeah.
well.
And look, this is where the frustration lies, is to the community, we've all been talking about this and concerned about this for such a long time. You know, then, of course, we saw the vision out of Alice Springs on A Current Affair, I think that it was really embarrassing for the whole of the Northern Territory to see ourselves in that way and think, wow, we've reached that point.
That is how it is.
That's
we see
right.
it every night.
Yeah, we do see these kinds of things happening. I mean, Falsey, why is it that we're now going, all right, well, we're hoping then to rush this through on urgency in May, and you know there is
the
concern. That's right, and there's a concern that then we could get it wrong. When, you know, this work could have been getting done for quite some time.
So, Katie, we have put in place a range of measures and we've been through that multiple times. In the last sittings, you saw ringleader legislation passed. What we've identified is six elements that we are working on presently that we believe listening to police and the courts will help make our justice system stronger and that people are held accountable, particularly youth. And so we're focused on that. In terms of the CLP's legislation that they presented, we received that at 8:30 the night before. And as the Chief Minister said, we didn't want to, you know, we hadn't even seen the explanatory statement that went with that. So we didn't want to put in place legislation that would potentially let people off.
It was six lines. Like, it was a really small piece of legislation. It was the first step to show the community that you were serious about making change. That was what it was about.
Yeah, and my understanding as well is that it was something that the Police Association had said that they support. I'm happy
industry.
To be corrected if
but
I'm wrong on
we
that.
We hadn't had advice from police. We hadn't had advice from Attorney General and Justice, the DPP, the courts, about that legislation because we received it at 8:30 the night before.
Katie,
and so government has many resources and there is a lot of work that is undertaken
that's
that goes
right.
into
oh,
legislation.
The police are working every single night and you easily could have called any one of them and they would have supported.
It's not as simple as calling the police who are on duty and saying, have a look at this piece
but
of legislation.
But again, you used to do
I'll
it though.
Go, yeah, I'll go back to the fact that this has been a long time coming. You know, even if we just look at this year, when there was some terrible incidents out of Queensland, I asked the Chief Minister on numerous occasions, and this is just this year. You know, I asked him on numerous occasions, well, why don't we look at changing some of this legislation? Why don't we look at changing that presumption of bail? And it was something that, you know, when I asked him yes or no, he'd said no. And so there was this real resistance.
Some of those interviews.
Yeah, there was this real resistance to it. And I just couldn't understand it. I thought, you know, all you got to do is walk down the street and talk to regular people. And you'd actually hear that they're incredibly frustrated, which, again, I think brings in that frustration as to then May, the Chief Minister saying, well, that's his preference. But then, you know, from what I'm hearing in this studio this morning, that's going to be awfully hard to make happen.
And we really need confidence right now. We need confidence from a leader, from our Chief Minister, to come out really strong and send a message to offenders that they are not going to get away with it, that he will move heaven and earth to bring in legislation fast on urgency to ensure that our community is safe. If he can't do that, then what is he actually doing?
360's The Week That Was. Thanks to DeSilva Hebron, your local lawyers.
You are listening to The Week That Was, proudly brought to you by DeSilva Hebron and now broadcasting on 8HA in Alice Springs. Now, we did talk yesterday quite extensively about some of the issues that we've seen in Karama of late. The member for Karama, Nari Arkit, joined us on the show and she said that there has been hundreds upon hundreds of visitors that have arrived in her electorate since last year. We know that there's been a spike in problems with crime in Karama. Earlier this week, we'd heard and we saw it reported in the NT News, Kiss, a business owner who has a beauty salon in Karama, had a gang of youths get into her business and demand money. We've heard a lot about break and entries and various damage in the suburb. But I think the thing that really frightened everybody the most, and your heart just goes out to the family, is the family of the little boy who was sexually assaulted a few weeks ago, allegedly, in the electorate of Karama. Now, We understand that there is always going to be people wanting to visit Darwin and wanting to visit the larger town centres, particularly Darwin and Alice Springs, and that is absolutely fine. But she hit the nail on the head, I think, yesterday, the member for Karama, when she said, if you're not going to add value to our little community, then please don't take it away. And this is the thing at the moment. There is a lot happening in that community. I didn't even mention the chroming, actually, and the serious issue that they've got at the moment with chroming. And let's not be fooled here into thinking that it's just Karama. You know, we've got these issues,
Katie,
across the board. And we really need to look a little bit more closely about how we deal with it. I had Larrakia Nation on the show yesterday as well, the CEO, Robert Cooper, who had said, you know, they've got their protocols and they expect people who visit the territory to adhere to those protocols.
Well, I mean, let's look at, I suppose, to go back to fundamentals or go back to basics, like, as you said, people can visit any city anytime for whatever reason, you know, legitimate reason. But the questions have to be asked is why is there such a high influx of visitors? Is there a reason? I don't know. And that's fine, but why are they staying? And is it because they're going to Karama? Because Karama obviously has, I think, high public housing. Is it because they're people in public housing? Or is it not? Is there something about Karama that we don't know? You know, socially?
It's actually not just about Karama. Karama has been what's in the news because of reporting. But this is happening right across the territory. And what I just can't get my head around is how the member for Karama has come out and stated the blatant obvious that people who are going to do the wrong thing and can't add to, you know, value to the community shouldn't be there. But what else is she doing? Like, she's introduced this coffee with a cop. The community have passed meeting with the cops. They know that the cops have been out trying to solve this problem. What people really need is for them to meet with their local member, have a street meeting, have multiple street meetings like I do in Palmerston.
So to bring in the rural area.
Yep.
Big bring one, them 300 people.
So that then when we come into Parliament, we share those stories and we push the government to make changes. And again, we go back to last month. We tried to bring forward changes and they shut it down.
Well, do you know, even yesterday morning, I got sent through photos from a resident in Karama who'd sent through photos of the playground, and there was people there drinking in the morning at that playground. She'd sent through as well photos of people sleeping around the bus stop. Again, we understand if there is a homelessness issue that you know, we all understand that, and there definitely needs to be facilities for people to stay if they are genuinely homeless. But if we're talking about people who've come to Darwin for a good time and to get their hands on alcohol, then it's a different story.
Katie, it's interesting in the territory homelessness, and we have a highly transient population, and people come into town for various reasons. And if you speak to someone that might be living rough, you know, they, in a year's time, they won't be in that same location versus interstate. If you speak to people that are homeless and living rough, they don't see a way out of it. So we do have this highly transient population. And so as a government, we've invested in short-term accommodation. So for people that are coming into town legitimately, that they've got a safe place and that they're not sleeping rough around the
community. If we're talking about hundreds upon hundreds of visitors, do we have enough?
So we've made a significant investment in that space in Batten Road. We know that, you know, urban public housing, we've made significant investments in that space. Alcohol, we've just been talking about that as a factor, and we have certainly got a comprehensive range of policies around alcohol. In terms of alcohol in remote communities, that's an issue that I think needs to be, you know, discussed, and it is being discussed. We've been working with the Commonwealth around that, because we need to make sure equally that our remote communities are places where people want to be, and they have access to services, and they have access to the same things that me or you want to have access to.
Well, and again, you know, this is something we've spoken about on so many occasions, specifically when we talk about alcohol and some of the alcohol policies that are in place. I mean, if we have got people who are coming to Darwin because they want to access and get their hands on alcohol, I mean, you and I have spoken about this before. I've spoken to the Chief Minister, I've spoken to the opposition, I've spoken to senators about it, previous senators about it. Why are we then, if you've got communities that are saying that they do want the opportunity to be able to enjoy a couple of drinks, if it's community-led and if the women in those communities are happy with it, why is it taking so long?
So, Katie, under the intervention and the Stronger Futures federal government legislation, liquor licences need to be approved by the Commonwealth, and that runs out in a very short period of time. I haven't got the exact timeframes in front of me. So we've been doing a body of work, particularly with some of the communities that have expressed, and it has to come from community and the leadership from community. And as you said, with children children and the safety of women and children, particularly at the forefront. But we are doing that work so that when that legislation changes, we can see, and this is part of having vibrant remote communities, place, you know, having access to those services that we all enjoy.
All right. One of the other things that that obviously we've spoken about over quite a long period of time is, well, firstly, and I've spoken to Mission Australia about this in the past, and also spoken to Larrakia Nation about it. Have we got enough beds when it comes to sobering up and also rehabilitation?
Yeah, Katie, we did a treatment demand survey in the past period of time, and that showed that we did have adequate beds. But I did note the comments from Mission Australia that they are reaching capacity. So I'll ask the agency, who work very closely with them, we've got the co-alignment of the detox, the sobering up, and then the rehabilitation, to make those pathways as easy as for individuals as possible. But yes, we're always looking at the services we've got, the number of beds, is it enough? And we'll certainly go back and look at that. But we have done that detailed work.
What about a wet camp? That's something that, again, you and I and all of us have spoken about before, but have we reached a point where this needs to be something that is seriously considered, not just spoken about?
So for your listeners, a wet camp is a place where people can reside and they are a permitted alcohol, so they can drink. It is very complex. These people have, in most cases, severe medical needs. They are very intensive programs, but the Riley Review did touch upon that, and there has also been other work to understand what would require for a wet camp to be set up and how potentially it could benefit the community but be safe.
Now, what about if we've got people in different suburbs around the Top End or in Central Australia that are from community and they're in town and they break the law, why don't we send them home?
So, Katie, if someone breaks the law, they will be charged by police and they will be then usually go through a court process. Once somebody leaves, if they are sentenced to a term of imprisonment, when they leave that prison, they're actually a free individual, and so they can go wherever they like in the territory. When I was the Minister for Corrections, we did do a body of work, though, Katie, noting that our prisons are in Darwin and Alice Springs. We've got the work camps in the Barkly and East Arnhem. Sounds like they're having a party out there, Wolfie.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm not sure what's going on.
I don't think they'll be listening to us, but they're having a bit of fun. But so we did do work around how we can try and repatriate people back to community so that we're making it as easy as possible, that we're not simply, you know, literally letting them out of our prisons in the urban areas and they get, you know, distracted and don't get back to community.
Katie, I mean, you touched on a good point. I mean, and I agree with Natasha, you know, free world, free individual, free citizens, freedom of movement, all that sort of stuff. But if a person does have a custodial sentence and they conclude their time and they come out and they're from a community, I think there should be some kind of relationship between the community elders or the people who are basically in the position of control and management, seniority in that community, to scoop that person up and take them home.
We do have programs, Kezia, so we have the Visiting Elders program, and so that's where we have elders from around the territory that are trained and they're leading. Leadership is recognised by our correction system, and they go into the prisons and start that work with prisoners when they're incarcerated, because, you know, it might be a case that they've done something wrong and they don't want to go back to community.
Like, whatever we're doing at the moment, if we've got hundreds upon hundreds of visitors in Karama alone, whatever we're doing is not working.
Katie, we've seen over the past 12 months the increased payments, and it's a difficult space when you talk about giving somebody enough money that they can actually buy fresh fruit and vegetables and try and lift themselves out of poverty. But it is really difficult when we know that money's being used for alcohol and gambling and other issues that cause harm in our community. These are complex issues that the federal and Northern Territory government have to work together on.
And I think that's why we need to really focus on getting these people back home. Like, that is the key here, because...
But we also have to have functioning remote communities. We have to have communities where people want to go and they want to stay, and we also have to respect, you know, outstations. Homelands are an important part of having people outside our urban areas.
Why wouldn't these communities be functioning? I mean, they should be functioning. They've got local government, they've got territory government, they've got Commonwealth government, they've got shires.
Overcrowding in housing under the CLP, we didn't see any houses delivered in remote communities. Like, these are all the issues.
Natasha, it's got to stop. I know the three businesses that are building houses for these remote communities, from Bullman to sanitaries to...
Absolutely. We've rolled out a strong program of addressing those issues.
$900,000 these houses are costing. You know, they're those really fabulous houses. They're bulletproof, literally. So they are being rolled out across the territory as we speak. NT-Link, I think Northern Transportables, and I think a PMT or someone like that. They are going to these communities. They're five-bedroom houses. They're four bedrooms. I get it, some communities will be have overcrowding issues because they have big families, they have lots of relations and all that sort of stuff. But somewhere along the line, we have to make sure that these communities are functioning. If they're not functioning, why aren't they functioning?
And if people keep choosing to do the wrong thing, and they don't want to live in the places that they live, and they go out and cause harm to other people, it needs to be addressed. It absolutely needs to be addressed because the community can't keep going like this. It's not sustainable.
Yeah. If the person, as you said, someone's done something wrong in the community, culturally they've done something wrong, and they've done a custodial because they've broken the law of the society, then that has to be addressed back in that community. If they've done something wrong culturally, that should be addressed in the community. And I'm not talking about payback and any of that sort of stuff. It should be addressed in the community such that that person can live in that community safely and honestly, and just go about their daily life into the future.
360's The Week That Was. Thanks to De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers.
Joining me in the studio this morning for The Week That Was, we've got Marie-Claire Boothby, Kezia Purick and Natasha Files. Now, throughout the week, we know that that the government announced, two new commissioners for the Territory Economic Reconstruction Commission. Now, I think that we'd all expected that there was going to be, I can hear you two whispering over there. I think we all thought that there was going to be at least one commissioner when it comes to the Territory Economic Reconstruction Commission, but then the government announced two commissioners, but they didn't actually announce who those commissioners were going to be. That's still to come. There's two people acting in these roles. They're going to have teams around them. They'll each oversee focus teams of about 10 specialist staff from Investment Territory with other surge staff to pivot between the two teams. Now, the biggest question right from the get-go was, how much are they going to get paid? I mean, we're all thinking around $300,000. Maybe I'm wrong.
Katie,
it seems like an awful lot of money. And,
that's only the beginning of it. I don't know what the Chief Minister's on, but I want some of it. I mean, seriously, you're talking two commissioners of $300,000, give or take.
Yep.
You're talking 20 staff. Now, 20 staff need 20 desks, 20 computers, 20 phones, 20 whatever. So you're looking at all the on costs. We're talking millions here. Now, this is the same Chief Minister who in the last sittings brought in amendments to the Mineral Royalty Act, which is going to be a disincentive to the exploration mining industry, which I know he doesn't understand because I've got no idea why he wanted to become the Treasurer in the first place. No consultation, not one piece of consultation with the mining industry in regards to amendments to the Mineral Royalty Act. Not one. Now, I know that because I've spoken to the industry. He doesn't understand it. And yet, on the other hand, he's creating two commissioners to generate investment and interest in the Northern Territory. On the other hand, he's putting in a disincentive. Come on, Chief Minister, what is it?
And this is on the back of Team Territory.
Team Territory, Territory
the other
Team,
ones? They all had these big names and these teams.
Yeah, what has happened now to Team Territory?
Exactly.
Does it get dissolved into it?
Nothing
what happened to Purple Territory?
What's Purple Territory?
It's boundless possible.
Yeah, that one.
There's still got you guys talking about it.
There's always
no one else is.
These commissioners are going to just be another level of
bureaucracy. 20 staff.
Yeah, and 20 staff in a department which already exists, which is already a very big department that has a lot of responsibilities.
Which department is it?
The Department of Trade, Industry and Tourism.
And business and something.
Yeah, I think it falls together into there. And again, though, I didn't have an issue with... I thought to myself, no, I do think that we need a commissioner. I do think that there needs to be somebody overseeing
the way that... guys had a territory bill.
Just about to bring that
up.
There
it was something similar.
But it was going to be different, wasn't it, in the sense that it was a statutory body?
That's right, a standalone.
Yes.
So it wasn't embedded into government because what we've seen embedded in government hasn't worked so far, so we wanted to do something different. But the biggest difference with the Territory Coordinator Bill, which was legislation, which we had ready to go last month, again got shut down by the government because they thought they had a better system, which we now found out is these two commissioners, which is the same system that they always try.
I think they copied you.
Well, they didn't even do that because what we did was we have a very specific step-in clause for the Territory Coordinator, which means that in the Territory we have a record of saying it takes 4 years to get an approval for a mining exploration licence compared to other states, which is only a few hundred days. And so the Territory Coordinator could support the organisation or agency or whoever it is that has a big major project to go and get approvals across the board, different things. If, say, the water licensee or the licensee Alcohol Licence yep. Commission, all those different commissions take too long. They can step in because they have the teeth to do that, to say, right, we actually need a decision with 90 days or 60 days, whatever it might be. If they don't make the decision, the territory coordinator becomes the decision maker so that they could get a yes or no. So they'll actually grab the file from that department, go through it with a fine-tooth comb with the resources that they have, which will come from the department, and make that decision so that we can have a yes answer
and
or
look,
a no answer.
You know, I think that you've pointed out a couple of things there that I think are good points, that, you know, then you've got something that's actually separate that can step in and go, well, hang on a second, we need to speed this along, or we need to actually help this, you know, this person who's put in a proposal to try and get things moving more quickly. The problem that I've got is it seems as though what we are creating is two more bureaucrats. Now, that's fine if you get, you know, and they're adding on, obviously, those teams. Yeah. Now, you know, I certainly do not have anything against bureaucrats. I've been one myself over the years. But you've got to make sure that you've got the right people in there who understand the way in which business is done and who understand what it's like to be on the outside. So an actual, you know, a standalone business on the outside trying to get something going, like you've said, Kezia, trying to get a major project going so that we can try to speed things along. And that's been one of the biggest criticisms of the government, I think, over the years. Not, you know, maybe not so much in the last 6 months, but over the years, that there has been this situation where, aside from Impex, we sort of had 4 years there of waiting for things to get going.
What power are they going to have as an investment commissioner if they can't step into another department and get an approval done? If there's no power, then nothing changes. We will continue to do the same thing over and over and get the same result, and that's insanity, of course.
The other question is, what will be their relationship to the key industry and business departments, for example, extraction mining and the business innovation?
And I actually thought the way that it was going to sort of roll out is, you know, I'd been at different events that I'd actually emceed, not only for the Territory Economic Reconstruction Commission, but also ones for industry, where my understanding was going to be that Team Territory was going to be a big part of the implementation of some of these different recommendations. And then also, my understanding was that it was going to fall through the Department of Business, which Sean Drabb heads up. So I'm just not, like, I'm sort
are
of trying to wrap my
Mr.
head around
Foss?
How it's all working.
I can't
roles?
Get a word in.
No, don't lie. You're sitting back there waiting for it all to happen. What's the go?
Katie, we know that we need to diversify our economy. The Territory's always had that boom and bust cycle from, you know, the Railway Parliament House, and Impex was our most recent. So this is around diversifying the economy. The Commissioner's aims are to go out there and find those projects, and then as the Major Projects Commissioner to drive them within government agencies. Marie-Claire's outlined her model. We believe that this is the best model to drive that investment so we can reach that significant economy by 2030.
Well, I don't know whether everybody agrees or not. It's hard to tell in this room, and we always get plenty of differing messages on the text line and on the phone
can
line.
Can I ask a question, Katie, Minister Files? Have those jobs been advertised?
So there'll be interim appointments, and then they'll be advertised, is my understanding.
With the salary that goes along with that, do we know what that salary is going to be? Like, we've thrown a few numbers around here.
So the Chief Minister announced that there was interim commissioners that are already existing members that will be appointed, and then those positions will go through the full public service process of advertising.
But there'll be executive roles, obviously, so we're anticipating what kind of pay level, I suppose.
Katie would have to get back to you on that, but they will be publicly advertised and go through that open process.
And this is after the freeze that we had of public servants.
Excuse me, and principals.
Yes.
You take a freeze to your pay packet, primary school principal, and yet the Chief Minister is quite happy to put people into these commissioners' role, which really no one understands. I don't believe we need them, given that, as you said, the Reconstruction Commission or whatever they were called.
It's
another desperate move by Michael Gunner to hang on to his job.
We have run out of time, unfortunately. It's always a struggle in here. We never have enough time. But anyway, Marie-Claire Boothby, always great to... great to have you in the studio for the first time.
Thank you. No, I've been here before, but the week that was is my first time.
Yes, exactly. Whole different ball game for the week that was.
It's been good. Kezia
Puric,
thank you.
Natasha Files, thank you.
Thanks, Wolf.
You are listening to Mix 104.9's 360. That was the week that was, brought to you by DeSilva Hebron, and also broadcasting on 8HA in Alice Springs.